4. Badly as it had started, Johnny could not believe the sensation of flight. He was lost in the huge co-pilot seat, and the belt that was supposed to keep him in would not contract enough to do so. But he braced himself with a grip on a handhold and watched the earth race away from him. He felt awe. Was this how it was to be an eagle? Is that how the world looked from the sky? The panorama of the mountains to the west began to open in relief, and in a few moments he realized they were now higher than High Peak, seen whitely in the cold, clear air. For 15 minutes he was enthralled. They were at a height of about 4 miles. He had never realized there was so much world, or that one could feel so thrilled. Then Turl said, "You can operate any of the mind machines, can't you, animal? Now, this is no different, except that it goes in 3 dimensions, not just 2. Those controls in front of you duplicate these. Fly it." Turl's paws came off the controls. The plane immediately flopped over. Johnny was thrown against the door. The plane staggered and began a sickening dive. Johnny had not paid any attention to what Turl was doing with the controls before. They were a maze of levers and buttons. He gripped the security belt and got himself into position to reach things. He started pushing buttons. The plane went crazy. It soared. It swooped. The ground rushed up and sped away. Turl's laughter cut above the roar. Johnny began to realize the creature was a bit high on Kerbango. Celebrating indeed. With a steady concentration, Johnny looked at the controls. As on all Cyclo equipment, everything was marked. Some of the terms he didn't know, but he spotted an additional button alongside every button familiar in mining machinery. He grasped that the 3rd set was for the 3rd dimension. The main thing, he instinctively knew, was not to get too close to that ground. He found a button for altitude and punched it. Although the plane was staggering, the ground began to fall away. This was too close to a win for Turl. "I'll take over," he said. "I got high honors as a pilot at the school. Watch me land on that cloud." A ragged top puff of cloud was ahead of them. Turl punched some buttons and stopped the plane on a flat place in the mist. "Trouble is, Ratbrain, you didn't watch what I was doing. You were too busy gawking at the scenery. But I guess if rats had been meant to fly, they'd be birds." He laughed at his own joke, reached behind his seat, and unstrapped a sealed container of Kerbango. He took a chomp on it and put it back. "First lesson, don't ever leave anything adrift in a plane. It'll fly around and bat your brains out. Not," he added with more laughter, "that rats have brains." He took off and made Johnny repeat the operation of landing and stopping. After the 3rd attempt, Johnny made it without being half down in the cloud. Johnny took off and started to fly toward the mountains. Turl instantly, and Johnny thought a bit fearfully, batted his hands away from the co-pilot controls and with his own turned the plane back.
"Not while I'm with you," growled Turl. His mood changed.
"Why not over the mountains?" asked Johnny. Turl scowled.
"Whenever you fly over those mountains, just make very sure you got no breathe gas loose any place. Understand?"
Johnny understood. He suddenly understood a lot more than Turl thought he did. "Why are you teaching me to fly?" asked Johnny, more to distract Turl from his line of thinking than because he believed Turl would tell him. He was right.
"Any miner has to know how to fly," said Turl.
Johnny knew that wasn't true. Care could fly, he was sure, since Care had said so. But Care had also said other miners were only interested in going underground, not above it. It was mid-afternoon when they landed the battle plane at the end of the row. Johnny had been right. It was the 20th plane. Turl inched it into precise position. He put on his breathe mask, opened the door, and gave Johnny a shove to get out.
"Don't get any ideas that you can start one of these things," said Turl. They require a special key to unlock the computers. He dangled a key in front of Johnny. I keep the one to this plane right here beside the remote control box.
He took the box out and looked at it.
Yep, all switches still open.
He showed Johnny the box.
And no dummy wires.
He laughed loudly.
That's pretty good. No dummy wires.
Johnny went off to round up his horses. Windsplitter had gone to Chrissy, and the three horses were standing outside the wooden barrier. Patty yelped to see him. He realized they had been worried by the horse showing up without him.
Got an antelope and a deer, Johnny called into the cage.
I was a little delayed looking for Kinnikinick. I found some, not very much, but it will flavor the meat. Chrissy was very pleased.
We can strip and smoke the meat, she called across the two barriers. There's plenty of ashes here, and we can tan the hides.
Johnny felt better.
Patty called,
Johnny, there's a huge grizzly bear skin in here. Did you kill it, Johnny?
Yes, Johnny had killed it. But he was not so sure that he hadn't killed the wrong beast. Later that evening, when Turl came to let him, supervised, into the cage, he gave the girls the skinned meat and hides to handle. He touched them reassuringly, hiding his wince at the way the collars chafed their throats. When he came out and Turl had locked up and turned the juice back on, Turl said,
I'm just an animal attendant, but I don't wire dummy wires.
He threw a stack of books at Johnny before he rumbled away.
Get your rat brain around these, animal. Tonight. Care will take up your instruction in the morning, so don't go chasing off on a rat hunt.
Johnny looked at the books. He was dimly getting an idea of what Turl must want out of him. The books were Beginner's Flight Manual and Teleportation in Relation to Manned and Drone Flight. The latter was clearly marked secret, not for alien race distribution. Could it be, thought Johnny, that Turl was acting well outside the business of the company? If so, it was doubly certain that he and the girls would be killed when they had served their purpose. Turl would not leave witnesses around. 5. Johnny and Care were engaged in ferrying mining machines and equipment to the defense base. The order to do so had come early that morning from Turl. The machinery freighter plane was parked with doors agape and ramps let down in the open field near the battle planes. A remarkably cowed zzt checked off a drilling machine as it was run up the ramp by Care. He raised the ramps and closed the doors. Johnny buckled himself into the co-pilot's seat, and Care slid behind the controls. The freighter lifted abruptly and spun to the west. Care flew low and kept the ship steady, for none of the machinery was lashed. Johnny did not even look at the ground flowing by. They had made this short trip several times. He was tired. For a week, he had been practicing flying all day and studying all night, and it was beginning to show. His headache, however, came from the text, Teleportation in Relation to Manned and Drone Flight. The flight part of it was far less interesting than teleportation. He felt that if he could grasp that, he might be able to do something to avert the fate he knew would come someday. The mathematics of the text were quite beyond him. They were cyclomathematics, a long way in advance of what he had studied. The symbols made his head spin. The history section at the start of the book was perfunctory. It simply stated that 100,000 years ago a cyclophysicist named N had untangled the riddle. Prior to this, it was thought that teleportation consisted of converting energy and matter to space and then reconverting it in another place so it would assume its natural form. But this had never been proven. N had apparently found that space could exist entirely independent of time, energy, or mass, and that all these things were actually separate items. Only when combined did they make up a universe. Space was dependent only upon three coordinates. When one dictated a set of space coordinates, one shifted space itself.
Any energy or mass contained in that space thereupon shifted with that space shift. In the matter of a motor such as this freighter had, it was just an enclosed housing in which space coordinates could be changed. As the coordinates changed, the housing was forced to go along, and this gave the motor power. That explained why these planes were run by a switchboard and not a thrust through the air. They didn't have to have wings or controls. Much smaller housings in the tail and on each side had similar sets of coordinates fed into them to climb and bank. A series of coordinates were progressively fed to the main motor, and it simply went forward or backward as the housed space occupied each set of coordinates in turn. Teleportation over vast distances worked the same way. Matter and energy were pinned to the space, and when it was exchanged with another space, they simply changed too. Thus, matter and energy would seem to disappear in one place and appear in another. They didn't actually change, only the space did. Johnny could see now how Earth had been attacked. Informed in some way of its existence, possibly from some cyclos station in this universe, the cyclos had only to fish in its coordinates. They evidently used a recorder of some sort. They cast the recorder out to a test set of coordinates, and then got it back and looked at the pictures. If the recorder vanished, they knew they had sent it into the mass of the planet. Then they just had to adjust the coordinates for a new recorder cast. In that way, they had sent the killer gas. When it dissipated, they had followed it with cyclos and weapons. That was how Earth had been wiped out and conquered. But it didn't tell Johnny how to reverse the process. Any cyclos station out there could transport new gas, or even an army to Earth at will. That was the point that was giving him a headache.